So we may as well begin. Are you ready? Yes. Attention. Here we go. Are you ready over there in the sound room? Very good. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this is the first sutta class since after the rains retreat of 2015. And I did ask Ajahn Bhumari which suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya we still haven't gone over in these classes. And today this is one of them, the Sandaka Sutta. And you must admit that all the really, really juicy best suttas we've already done. But this is not such a bad sutta, so I didn't mind doing this one. I think the reason it hasn't been done before, it is a little bit long in pages, but the essence of it is actually quite simple. So here we go, the Sandaka Sutta. You have? Well, Ajahn Bhumari said no. Well, Ajahn Bhumari's getting old too. Maybe forget. You're getting old, but you remember. So anyway, okay. Anyway, we're going to do it whether it's been done before or not. Thus have I heard, on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Kosambi in Gosita's Park. And they always start every sutta, thus I have heard, and they say where the Buddha was living. In some suttas you find it doesn't mention where the Buddha was living, and that is code for that sutta was just after the Buddha passed away. Now on that occasion the wanderer Sandaka was staying in the Pilaka tree cave, with a large assembly of wanderers. Wanderers were ascetics, religious seekers, people looking for some spiritual guidance, not really part of any particular community. They would just go from one teacher to another teacher. Then when it was evening, the Venerable Ananda rose from meditation and addressed the monks thus, "Come, friends, let us go to the Devakata pool to see the cave." "Yes, friend," those bhikkhus replied. Then the Venerable Ananda went to the Devakata pool together with a number of other monks. Now on that occasion the wanderer Sandaka was seated with a large assembly of wanderers who were making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking about many kinds of pointless talk, such as talks of kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, gardens, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, street, wells, the dead, trifles, and the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or not so. And of course that is code for sort of this type of talk, which you can hear at a pub on a Saturday night, which you can hear in a coffee shop, where people just talk about all sorts of stupid things, and sometimes if you go to Bodhinyan, you can hear it in a coffee club after lunch. And probably a Dhammasara too. Very good, is that true? Yes, yes, yes. So it's just like, sorry? Football, yeah, football here and also. So it's just about politics and stuff. Then the wanderer Sandaka saw the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance. Seeing him, he quieted his own assembly thus, "Sirs, be quiet. Sirs, make no noise. Here comes a recluse Ananda, a disciple of the recluse Gotama, one of the recluse Gotama's disciples staying at Kosambi. These venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined in quiet. They command quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly is quiet one, he will think to join us." Then the wanderers became silent. It gives like a little bit of an indication that, you know, you go to monasteries and they're very peaceful and quiet for most of the day. And I remember many monasteries I went to in Thailand, you go in there and you didn't think there was anybody there. Hundreds of monks were there, or even many nuns. You couldn't hear a word. They're all quietly meditating. That's a really good monastery. The Venerable Ananda went to the Venerable Wanderer Sandaka, who said to him, "Let Master Ananda come. Welcome to Master Ananda. It is long since Master Ananda found an opportunity to come here. Let Master Ananda be seated. The seat is ready." Then Venerable Ananda sat down on the seat made ready, and the Wanderer Sandaka took a low seat and sat down at one side, which is a mark of respect. And when he had done so, it's just like when people sit here, you know, because the teacher has to take the high seat, you take a lower seat, and also sometimes to one side. Because I know that sometimes it can be disconcerting as a monk, when someone props themselves right in front of you, and they sit looking at you like that. It's quite disconcerting, especially the same young woman every time. You wonder what she's up to. But anyway, that was just a bit of, it's okay, you don't need to do that here, you're far enough away. But you can understand that it's, when they sit right in front of you, it's like demanding your attention. So I sat down on one side. When he had done so, the Venerable Ananda asked him, "For what discussion are you sitting together here now, Sandaka? And what was your discussion that was left unfinished?" "Master Ananda, let that discussion for which we are now sitting together here, let that be. Master Ananda can well hear about it later. It would be good if Master Ananda would give a talk on his own teacher's Dhamma," in other words, the Buddha's Dhamma. So that's just a prologue here to get a nice talk from Venerable Ananda. "Then, Sandaka, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, sir," he replied, and the Venerable Ananda said this. And just like you're supposed to do these days, if you are giving a talk, you say what you're going to talk about first of all, give the summary, then expand upon it, and then summarize it at the end. And this is how it's done here. "Sandaka, these four ways that negate the living of the holy life have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. And also these four kinds of holy life without consolation have been declared, wherein a wise man or woman would certainly would not live the holy life. If they should live it, they would not attain the true way, the Dhamma that is wholesome." So yeah, it is really, in one sense, about, you know, becoming a monk or a nun, and what makes being a monk or a nun totally useless, and what is like the consolation, you know, the benefits of becoming, you know, real benefits of becoming a monk or a nun. But it also means there's the whole idea of Buddhism itself. There's four things which negate the very heart of Buddhism, and also which makes the whole practice of really giving a lot of energy and effort and letting go to this Buddhism, that without any consolation you do so much but there's nothing there for you. So what are the holy life without consolation? So even though it's mostly aimed at monks and nuns, it's also aimed at lay people as well. So, that was the intro. "But Master Ananda, what are those four ways that negate the living of the holy life that has been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened? Wherein a wise man or woman certainly would not live the holy life. Or if he should live it, he would not attain the true way, the Dhamma that is wholesome." So number one, which negate a living of a holy life. And these are like four ways of philosophy here. And you may recognize that the first one is what we usually call materialism. "Here, Sandaka, some teacher holds such a doctrine and view as this. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad action, no this world, no the other world, no father, no mother, no beings who are me-born spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world." So what they're saying over there, nothing given, nothing offered, is no result of good karma. Generosity is just a waste of time. No good action, no bad actions. Where it said, no this world, no the other world. In other words, once you die, that's it. No, there's no further world. No mother, no father. Respecting and looking after your parents is just no good karma there at all. No beings reborn spontaneously means heavenly beings. No good and virtuous recluse and Brahmins who themselves realized by direct knowledge is no one who's enlightened, it's saying. And a person just consists of the four great elements, it's just stuff. When he dies, earth returns and goes back to the body of earth, it's dust to dust. Water returns back to water. Fire returns, goes back to the body of fire. Air returns to air. The faculties are transferred to space. Four men with the bier as the fifth carry away the corpse. The funeral orations last as far as the charnel ground. The bones whiten, burnt offerings end with ashes. Giving is a doctrine of fools. When anyone asserts the doctrine there is giving and the like, it is empty, false prattle. Fools and the wise are alike cut off and annihilated with the dissolution of the body. After death, they do not exist. All they're saying there is there's no karma, no rebirth. So we're all the same in this doctrine. That once you're dead, and that's it. So about this, a wise man considers. This good teacher holds a doctrine of view. There is nothing given. They always repeat these things. After death, they do not exist. If this good teacher's words are true, then here, in his teaching, I have already done my duty by not doing anything. I've already lived a holy life by not living it. Because both of us are exactly equal there. Both have arrived at equality. You know, where you're good or you're bad, where you're generous or you're not generous, you'll end up the same at death. But here they said, yet I do not say that both of us are cut off, annihilated with the dissolution of the body. Just Ananda saying that, you know, this is the wrong idea, but nevertheless, if that is the idea, that after death we should not exist. But it is superfluous for this good teacher to go about naked, to be shaven, to exert himself in the squatting posture, and to put out his hair and beard. You know, this is the teacher saying this, because I, who live in a house crowded with children, who use Benares sandalwood, that's, you know, best type of, that's like Chanel number 5, who wear garlands, scents, and unguents, and accept gold and silver, that's money, shall reap exactly the same destination, the same future course as this good teacher. What do I know and see that I should lead the holy life under this teacher? So he finds that this way negates the living of the holy life, he turns away from it and leaves it. So it says that anyone whose teaches there's no karma, there's no rebirth, there's no point in sort of living a life like that. Instead, if that was the case, just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And as far as the law of karma is concerned, no need to do good stuff, just make sure you're not caught. To die before they catch up with you. So that word, you see, that philosophy actually negates the living of a holy life, of doing good karma, being generous. Okay, yeah, being generous and kind, you get some benefits right now, but it doesn't give the oomph to the importance of doing good and being kind and actually practicing and developing your mind. So this is the first word that negates the living of the holy life that has been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished, and fully enlightened, wherein a wise man certainly would not live the holy life. Or if they should live it, they would not attain the true way, the Dhamma dissolves. That's the first one. And again, Sandaka, here some teacher holds such a doctrine of view as this. When one acts or makes another person act, when one mutilates or makes another's mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow or makes others inflict sorrow, when one oppresses or makes others inflict oppression, when one intimidates or makes others inflict intimidation, when one kills living beings, takes what is not given, breaks into houses, plunders wealth, commits burglary, ambushes highways, seduces another person's wife, utters false, no evil is done by the doer. If with a razor-rimmed wheel one were to make the living beings of this earth into one mass of flesh, into one heap of mincemeat, because of this there would be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the south bank of the Ganges, killing and slaughtering, mutilating and making others mutilate, torturing and making others inflict torture, because of this there would be no evil and no outcome of evil. If one were to go along the north bank of the Ganges, giving gifts and making others give gifts and making offerings and making others make offerings, because of this there will be no merit, no outcome of merit. By giving, by taming oneself, by restraint, by speaking the truth, there is no merit and no outcome of merit. In other words, just the whole idea of just doing good, even in this life. You just dog-eat-dog world. So, you know, it's just the kind people, generous people, the good people finish second. So you be a winner. You just go and do what you want to do. That's that type of teaching. About this, a wise man considers, this good teacher holds the doctrine in view, when one acts there is no merit and no outcome of merit. If this good teacher's words are true, then here in this teaching, I've already done my duty by not doing it. Here I've already lived a holy life by not living it. Both of us are exactly equal here in this teaching. Both of us have arrived at equality. Yet I do not say that whatever both of us do, no evil is done. That's my belief. But it is superfluous for this good teacher to go around doing good when he says there's no point in doing good. So what do I know and see that I should leave the holy life under this teacher? So when he finds that this way negates the living of the holy life, he turns away from it and leaves it. That's the second way that negates the living of the holy life. Has been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees accomplished and fully enlightened. So the first one is like no rebirth, basically. The first is no good karma or bad karma. And, you know, even no results even in this life, let alone a future life. And the third way, which negates living of any religious life. Again, Sandhika, here some teacher holds such a doctrinal view as this. There is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause and condition. And just you are who you are. You're an idiot, you're angry, you're pain. No one can blame you, that's just who I am. So don't need to try and do anything better, because I can't do anything. It's just, I'm an old nasty person, so you better learn how to live with that. That's that type of, this type of doctrine. But here, in full. There is no cause and condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. There is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause or condition. There is no power, no energy, no manly strength or womanly strength, no manly or womanly or gay, lesbian, transgender strength. Sorry. No, all beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power and energy, moulded by destiny, circumstance and nature. They experience pleasure and pain in the six classes of pleasure and pain. That's the six senses. My destiny, I can't do anything about it. So, you know, this is who I am. And so you better, again, learn to live with it. I can't do anything. I can't take responsibility, because if I'm an evil, bad person, it's maybe circumstances' fault. I can't do anything about it. And I can't purify myself. It's impossible. This is just the destiny of myself here. This is the way I'm made. So, of course, you can see how that stops any idea of a holy life in any type of religion. Because people go to churches, to temples. You know, they want to improve themselves. They want to become better people, kinder people, more generous people. They want to make a better world. That's an important part of the holy life. But if it's all destiny, it means whether you go to church, whether you meditate, whether you keep precepts or you don't keep precepts, it's all the same. About this, the man considers, this good teacher holds this doctrine of view, there is no cause in the six classes, blah, blah, blah. If this good teacher's words are true, then here in this teaching, I've already done my duty by not doing it. Here I've already lived a holy life by not living it. Both of us are exactly equal here in this teaching. Both have arrived at equality, the teacher and the person seeking to come into the teaching. Yet I do not say that both of us will be purified without cause and condition. I don't agree with that. But it is superfluous for this good teacher to go around practicing the way he does. Because whether he does practice or doesn't do the practice, doesn't make any difference. What do I know and see that I should lead the holy life under this teacher? So when he finds that this way negates the living of the holy life, he turns away from it and leaves it. This is the third way that negates the living of the holy life. That has been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees accomplished and fully enlightened. So you see the first one again, no rebirth. Second one is just, there's no good karma, a result of any karma. And a third way is that the way it's just destiny, so it doesn't matter what happens, what we do, it's all going to be the same. And the fourth way, here some teacher holds such a doctrine of view as this. This is my favorite one. There are these seven bodies that are unmade, not brought forth, uncreated, without a creator, barren, standing like mountain peaks, standing like pillars. They do not move or change or obstruct each other. None is able to arouse move or change. No one is able to arouse pleasure or pain, or pleasure or pain in another. Pleasure and pain in another. What are the seven? The earth body, the water body, the fire body, the air body, pleasure, pain, and the soul is the seven. These seven bodies are unmade, and undestroyable. Herein there is no killer, no slaughterer, no hearer, no speaker, no cognizer, no intimator. Even those who have cut off somebody's head with a sharp sword do not deprive anyone of life. The sword merely passes through the space between the seven bodies. There are these 1,400,000 principal kinds of generation, and 1,600 kinds, and 600 kinds. There are 500 kinds of action, and five kinds of action, and three kinds of action, and action and half action. There are 62 ways, 62 sub-eons, 6 classes, 8 planes of man, 4,900 kinds of livelihood, 49 kinds of wanderers, 4,900 abodes of serpents, 2,000 faculties, 3,000 hells, 36 elements of dust, 7 percipient breeds, 7 non-percipient breeds, 7 sheathless breeds, 7 kinds of gods, 7 kinds of men, 7 kinds of demons. There are 7 lakes, 7 knots, 7 kinds of chasms, 700 kinds of chasms, 7 kinds of dreams, 700 kinds of dreams, and there are 8,400,000 great eons wherein, by running and wandering through the round of rebirths, fools and the wise both will make an end of suffering. There is none of this. If you're a mathematician, that by the virtual observance of asceticism or holy life, there is none of this. Namely, by this virtual observance or asceticism or holy life, I shall make unripened action ripen or annihilate ripened action as it comes. Pleasure and pain are meted out. The round of rebirth is limited. There is no shortening or extending it, no increasing or decreasing it. Just as a ball of string, when thrown, goes as far as the string unwinds, so too, by running and wandering through this round of rebirth, fools and the wise both will make an end of suffering. That's amazing. If you've ever been to India, you know, just know they love philosophy, and they love actually categorizing 62 ways and 62 sub-eons, 6 classes, 8 planes of men, 4,900 kinds of livelihood. And sometimes they really get into that. And don't think the Buddhists are exempt from that, because sometimes, and remember the exams they used to give to the monks, the young monks in Thailand, they had to learn all the 7 of this and the 8 of that and the 6 of something else. Just the categorizations of Buddha's philosophy. But anyway, the main part of this, I don't understand what they're talking about here. I must admit, I do not know the 3,000 hells, or what is it, the 30, or the 4,900 abodes of serpents. I am quite ignorant of that, please excuse me. But, in particular, they say that Jesus' life will just go on and on. Whether you practice or you don't practice, you know, you serve a certain amount of pleasure, a certain amount of pain, and in the end that you just end up, when the eon's finished, then you finish with it, and that's the end of it. Interestingly there, I do recognize that where it says here that if one were to cut off someone's head with a sharp sword, it does not deprive anyone of life, the sword merely passes through the space between the 7 bodies. I remember hearing that before. That's in the Bhagavad Gita. And you know, I thought, when I read that, it doesn't make any sense. It just justifies killing. So you're not killing anybody. It's just a sword passing through stuff. So, I mean, that's a philosophy which makes a lot of morality irrelevant. About this, a wise man considers. This good teacher holds the doctrine in view. These are the 7 bodies, so-so. Fools and the wise both will make an end of suffering. If this good teacher's words are true, then here in this teaching I have done my duty by not doing it. Here I have lived a holy life by not living it. Both of us are exactly equal here. In this teaching both have arrived at equality. Yet, I do not say that both of us will make an end of suffering by running and wandering through the round of rebirths. It is superfluous, but it is superfluous for this good teacher to go about naked, to be shaven, to exert himself in a squatting position, to put out his hair and beard, since I who live in a house crowded with children use Benares sandalwood, who wears garland scents and unguents, and except gold and silver shall reap exactly the same destination, the same future course as this good teacher. What do I know and see that I should live the holy life under this teacher? So when you find that this way negates the living of the holy life, you turn away from it and leave it. This is the fourth way that negates the living of the holy life that has been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Now summarizing, these Sandika are the four ways that negate the living of the holy life that has been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. Wherein a wise man certainly will not live the holy life. If he should live it, he will not attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. So to summarize that, if we say there is no rebirth, no life after death, again, means we're all the same. It doesn't matter what you do. Good people, bad people, all end up the same. Disappear. Now, there's no karma, there's no goodness, badness. Even in this life you don't have any benefit from doing good stuff. Then it makes the whole idea of morality and being good and striving and struggling, keeping precepts, makes it sort of useless. No point to it. You know, and the third way of what's the third way? That's right, there is no cause and condition, it's destiny. Everything is destiny. It means that you don't have to do anything. You're destined to have this, have that. You don't have to put on the effort, do anything, strive, do anything at all. It's just all destiny. And the fourth way is there's nothing really here. It's just seven bodies. There's no anything else. So again, there is, and we all eventually get enlightened after so many lifetimes. Actions, goodness, striving, struggling, doing stuff, even letting go has no meaning. So those are the four ways which negate the living of the holy life. Questions? A humanist.
Humanist who believes
that... did you say humorist? I'm a humorist.
Who believes that it is good to do good in this life. They don't believe it in a life like death. They want to do good in this life because this is the only life we have. And that, you know, and they're very, very sincere.
Yes, if it's a humanist, again, it's
highly ethical and moral.
So. Highly ethical.
So how would you sell this? If you say that it's only if you believe in rebirth that that's the only reason for being good.
This was one of those. They say that even the second one is where they don't believe in any morality at all. You're good or you're bad, so there is no results of that at all. Not even in this life, even the second life. This, how I respond to that, there was the Nagha Sutta which the Buddha said, where he said that those people who don't believe in a rebirth in a future life, still they know there is results of goodness and kindness. Might as well do it anyway. Yes, so both ways you win. If there is no rebirth, then you have a happy life, you're a good person. And that, you know, being kind to others, being generous to others, and that gives you a lot of peace and happiness and uplift. So, you know, whether there is a future life or not, you certainly win. And if there is a future life, you win twice over.
Yes, I like that.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it. So both ways you win.
Bet both ways.
Yeah. But here...
Hedge your bets.
You did see in the first one, I was only just summarizing it. The first one was by saying, by not believing in any rebirth, then they use that also as a justification for not doing anything good or in this life. You know, it's just the case that, you know, the eat, drink, be merry for tomorrow we die idea. See if you can get away with it.
For Bhante, these were ascetics. They weren't really eating or drinking.
No, they weren't really eating or drinking. These ones were really struggling hard. Ascetics, I mean, giving up a lot of pleasures of life which were available to them. Many of them were naked. If they weren't naked, they were certainly not well dressed and living a very harsh, austere lifestyle. But nevertheless, these were ideas which were around at the time. And teachers were teaching this, and Ananda was saying that if you have a teacher who teaches this, any of these four teachings, then this makes no sense following it. If there's no rebirth, okay, if you understand things, there's some happiness from doing good stuff, but sometimes people do good stuff and they don't get happiness. And sometimes, this is one of the arguments which people often say, there are people in this world who are pretty mean and cruel, and they seem to be getting away with it. And good people seem to sometimes suffer. No, the aesthetics of the time. These were like just... Yeah,
what's the point of being aesthetic?
Exactly. This is the four reasons which negate being aesthetic. Because the ascetics, they were training their bodies, they were renouncing so many pleasures, they were restraining their desires. And they were doing that for the purpose of some sort of enlightenment, some sort of benefit. Now, either to end, and a lot of them had the idea of rebirth, and to end the cycle of rebirth, like the Buddha did. And others were just wanting to find some meaning in their life, some truth. So they were saying that maybe if you did, like the Christian idea, to mortify the body, to free the soul, and to get some great deep wisdom. And that seems to be an idea which was current in India at that time. It's been current in the world. Thinking the only way to get wisdom and to break through to truth is to get beyond the body by treating it quite cruelly and harshly. To overcome the desires of the body by austerity. But anyway, but now we go to something a little bit more positive. Oh, well, a little bit negative first of all, we get the positive stuff. Again, go forward again. It is wonderful, Master Ananda, it is marvelous how the four ways to negate the living of the holy life have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. This is paragraph 20. But, Master Ananda, what are those four kinds of holy life without consolation that have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened? Wherein a wise man certainly would not live the holy life, or if they did live it, would not attain the true way the Dhamma that is wholesome. No consolation and no finding out the truth. Here, Sandika, some teacher claims to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision, thus, whether I am walking or standing or sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present in me. Because that was supposed to be what they wanted of their spiritual leaders, to be omniscient at all times. So, he enters an empty house, and he gets no alms food. A dog bites him. He meets with a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull. He asks the name and clan of a woman or a man, he doesn't know their name. He asks the name of a village or town, and the way to go there. When he is questioned, how is this? He replies, I had to enter an empty house. That is why I entered it. I had to get no alms food. That is why I did not get any. I had to be bitten by a dog. That is why I was bitten. I had to meet with a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull. That is why I met with them. I had to ask the name of a clan of a woman or man. That is why I asked. I had to ask the name of a village or town and the way to go there. That is why I asked. So in other words, they're not really omniscient. They're just trying to make excuses. And that's another sutta there. There was one of the leader of the Jains, which was maybe even more famous than the Buddha in those days, most scholars agree to. He had a huge number of followers. He was supposed to be omniscient. And somebody decided to test out his omniscience. So this layperson invited him to dana at the house. And on the way into the house, the owner of the house dug a big pit, filled it full of cow shit, and covered it over with a few branches and grass as a booby trap. And he thought, if this great teacher is omniscient, he will know that there's a booby trap there, and you go around it. This is the way I can find out whether he's omniscient or not. whether he's got the powers or not. And this monk went right into the pit and fell right in. He said, "Ah, you're not on this end, you should have known." He said, "No, I knew it was there, but I had to do this, you know, to show my humility and to not sort of claim omniscience. I had a reason to fall into this pit." So he made excuses. I remember my math teacher, whenever he made a mistake on the chalkboard, you know, we pointed out, "You made a mistake." He said, "Yeah, that was the deliberate mistake of today, just to make sure you're all awake." He said, "I did that on purpose. I'm your teacher, I don't make mistakes." Have you had a teacher like that? Yeah, okay, well, it goes around. Well, about this a wise man considers. This good teacher claims to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision. When he is questioned, "How is this?" he replies, "I had to. That's why I asked." So when he finds that his holy life is without consolation, he turns away from it and leaves it. In other words, his teachers are flawed. This is the first kind of holy life without consolation that's been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein a wise man says he would not live the holy life, or if he should live it, would not attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. And so some teachers actually sometimes do claim that omniscience and stuff. It's really gross in some traditions. Again, Sadhaka. And this is more topical now, because you can see actually what this refers to. Here some teacher is a traditionalist, one who regards the oral tradition as the truth. And by oral tradition, we might even say what is written in the holy books as truth. He teaches a Dharma by oral traditions, by legends handed down, by what has come down in scriptures. But when a teacher is a traditionalist, one who regards oral tradition as truth, some is well remembered and some is wrongly remembered. Some is true and some is otherwise. About this, a wise man considers thus. This good teacher is a traditionalist. Some is true and some is otherwise. So when he finds that his holy life is without consolation, he turns away from it and leaves it. So you can see that the people are fundamentalists in the tradition of a Bible, a Quran, or anything, even this stuff. As they often say, we can usually find out what the Buddha said, but what did he mean? Or what did the Prophet Muhammad? We know sometimes nobody said, but what did he mean by that? And people interpret it so many different ways. And that's why you have what we call moderate Muslims and extremist Muslims. Just which way you interpret it. So it's not just the truth of the tradition. The interpretation is also a huge part of the problem. So here it says, this is again a holy life without much consolation. Yeah, you follow tradition, but the interpretation of the tradition, some is true, some is false. Some was okay at that time, but we've moved on since then. And even Buddhism, if you read some of the suttas, there's some of the stuff here which you might read, one of the great suttas you want to read if you want to lose your faith, it's coming from Ajahn Brahm, is now the 32 marks of a great man. You know that sutta, it's a great sutta to read, but this is ridiculous stuff, because it has all these marks which a Buddha is supposed to have. And if he had all those marks, he'd be a freak, you know, a circus show person, you know, because it's weird stuff. And so people, they try and find out all sorts of interpretations of that sutta. But the very least, you know, we just put that off, you know, that's not important. We don't have to follow it and believe it. Some is true, some is false. That's what it says in here. So you're not a traditionalist, because you know some is true and some is otherwise. Some has been rightly remembered, some wrongly remembered. And of course interpretation is also important. This is the second kind of holy life without real consolation, that has been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. The next one is the professors. Again, Sandhika, here a certain teacher is a reasoner, an inquirer. He teaches a Dharma hammered out by reason, following a line of inquiry as it occurs to him. But when a teacher is a reasoner, an inquirer, some is well reasoned and some is wrongly reasoned. Some is true and some is otherwise. And about this, a wise man considers thus, this good teacher is a reasoner. Some is true and some is otherwise. So when he finds that his holy life is without consolation, he turns away from it and leaves it. That's the third kind of holy life without consolation that has been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees the company of the 49th. Now, just done by logic, by reason. And you only have to go to a debate to see that very intelligent people or very strong reasoners can have these great arguments. And I must admit that I lost a lot of faith in reason, you know, when you started to do theoretical physics. Because some things there made no sense at all. But they were true. Irrational. Simple things, such as Alpha Centauri, I think, is it 5 light years away? That's the closest star. 5 light years away. And you cannot travel faster than the speed of light. But you can get there in 5 minutes. And people say, that's irrational. You can't do things like that. If it's 5 light years away and you can't travel faster than the speed of light, there's no way you can get there in 5 minutes. But you can. So a lot of times, reason sort of sometimes is just so limited. And that's one of the great things about science. You saw this, your reason. You weren't seeing the full picture, which is one of the reasons why your reason was very limited and came to false conclusions. So, reason is not good enough. It doesn't mean you abandon reason, but you don't just rely on it by itself. That negate, that gives the holy life without consolation. And of course, you've seen that so often. People argue, reasoning about what's right, what's wrong. There's no consolation there. And that's the third kind. The fourth kind. Again, Sandaka, here a certain teacher is dull and confused, but doesn't want to tell other people that. Because he is dull and confused, when he is asked such and such a question, he engages in verbal wriggling, in ill wriggling. I don't say it is like this. I don't say it is like that. And I don't say it is otherwise. And I don't say it is not so. And I don't say it is not so. So these are those teachers, well, I'm sure you've met, who say things and they are so deep. You don't understand a word of it and you think, wow, that's profound. I used to come across teachers like that. You know, they say a total gobbledygook, made no sense whatsoever, but you know, because they were a great Zen master or something, I thought, wow, that must be deep. And when you analyse, it wasn't deep at all. They didn't know what they were talking about. It was called ear wriggling, verbal wriggling. I like the term ear wriggling, so trying to get out of it. So sometimes, I must admit, I do that sometimes when you ask me a question I'm not allowed to answer, and I say, he who says doesn't know, he who knows doesn't say. That's a great example of ear wriggling. In other words, you get out of answering the question. So, about this, a wise man considers, this good teacher is dull and confused, engages in verbal wriggling, in ill wriggling, so when he finds that his holy life is without consolation, he turns away from it and leaves it. That's the fourth kind of holy life without consolation that has been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. I also should say that the ill wriggling is usually the form of argument used by politicians. They never give a straight answer when put on the spot. That is one of the great tricks of eel wriggling. It is wonderful, Master. These, Sandaka, are the four kinds of holy life without consolation that have been declared by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein a wise man certainly would not live the holy life, or if he should live it, would not attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. It is wonderful, Master Ananda, it is marvellous how the four kinds of holy life without consolation have been declared by the Blessed One, who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened. But, Master Ananda, what does that teacher assert, what does he declare, wherein a wise man or woman certainly would leave the holy life, and while living it, would attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome? So, here, Sandaka, a Buddha appears in the world accomplished, fully enlightened. And here we have what is called the gradual training. It's got dot, dot, dot here. But what this actually means, in brief, is you get faith, you know, in the Buddha's teachings, and from that faith, then you start to get your morality in order. Especially if you were a monk or a nun, you start to purify your morality, living a more simple life, being kind, being gentle, and then you practice precepts, like five precepts, and then you purify your mind through sense restraint, you don't indulge so much in stuff, and then you start meditating, and the first thing when you meditate is to restrain the five hindrances, and the five hindrances of wanting, ill will, restlessness and remorse, sloth and torpor, and lastly doubt, restraining the five hindrances. It becomes a practice rather than a belief. And of course, the first four things which negate the holy life, there's only one life, there's no resulting good karma, everything is destined, or what was the last one again? There is no things anyway, there's just seven bodies, and whatever you do doesn't really make any difference. Of course, by practicing, by having a course of practice, that actually will never make any sense if those four things, four philosophies which negate the holy life, were held by you. There is something to be done, there is something to be trained. There is an opportunity to develop yourself and to end suffering. Once you understand that, then you may embark on such a training. And also, that you have a holy life which is not without consolation, because the Buddha never says, omniscient, believe me. The Buddha is actually giving that knowledge to you, teaching you how you could be knowledgeable, rather than believing in somebody else. And you don't just go according to tradition, don't believe the tradition, you don't just believe reason, and you don't sort of just stop when people just don't give you a proper answer, you find it out for yourself. So those four things which negate the holy life, which don't give it consolation, are not there when you have a practice by which you can find out things by yourself. And does that make sense? And so 43, having thus abandoned these five hindrances, and this is where we pick up onto in this sutta, having abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from the five senses, secluded from unwholesome states, this is my translation now, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object with the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the five senses. And a wise man or woman certainly would live the holy life with a teacher under whom a disciple attains such a lofty distinction. And while living it, you would attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. So this is the first part of consolation of a holy life. By doing a practice which restrains the senses, keeps the morality. Why? Because it's important, it's the foundation for overcoming these five hindrances, which are the obstacles to getting into a jhana. You can see there that as soon as the five hindrances are gone, moves seamlessly straight into the jhanas. They've often taught you, five hindrances, when they go, the door of jhanas is opened. That's what happens. So just, I'm going to go on that again, the five hindrances, the wanting, sometimes called karmachanda. Karmachanda is just the wanting of the five senses, body stuff. It's that attachment to the body and the senses. Why can't we just not listen? Why can't we just not feel the body? Why can't we just turn those things off? It's because there's an attachment to that body, an attachment to those senses. And that's what we learn, how to sort of cut off. So that when you don't see anything, that's the easy one. You don't hear anything, smell, taste, and the body vanishes, you can't feel any physical touch. Basically, there's nothing now between you and the jhanas. And part of that desire, that attachment, that involvement and entanglement with the body and its five senses is also the cause of aversion, ill will, the second hindrance. Restlessness never gives you enough time for these things to disappear. Sloth and torpor, you're too dull to know what's going on, and doubt is also a great hindrance. So when those five hindrances, especially those first one, is gone, doors to jhana is open. Now you get some consolation. This is no longer a theory. It's not hammered out by reason anymore. It's not just according to some tradition. This becomes now a direct experience. And it's interesting, they stop here as the first of the consolations of the holy life. You know, getting into some deep meditation. Not just becoming a famous teacher. That's not consolation of a holy life. Not getting a nice big monastery to live in. Not having lots of disciples. That's no consolation. That's a pain in the ass. I'm being honest with you. But what is the consolation? Is just being able to just go off into your heart again as a deep meditation. That's the payoff of this life. Yeah, you can live, keep five precepts. You feel happy. You know, you can give a good life. But it's in other traditions you can also sort of be a good person and get consolation, do good works. But the payoff of this path is when you get into those deep meditations. That's why the thing which sets this path apart is learning how to meditate and really get deep. And just one of those in your lifetime, that gives you enough consolation. Wow. Now you know what Buddhism is about. The first consolation of this path, not just for a monk or a nun, for anyone. So anyone, a wise person, certainly would leave the holy life with a teacher under whom a disciple attained such a lofty distinction. And when they live it, they would also get those. And get a Dharma which is wholesome, at least the jhanas. Comes more in a moment. And again, with the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, when that just all stills away and you're totally sort of solid, no movement at all, you enter upon and abide in the second jhana. And there's always dot, dot, dots with the jhana. Sometimes I wish they'd actually put the whole of the jhanas in every time and then you would actually see just how important this is in the sutras. But anyway, here we go. Dot, dot, dot. With the fading away as well of rapture, you enter upon and abide in the third jhana, the abandoning of pleasure and pain in all those six senses, including the mind. You enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana. A wise man or woman, lay or monastic, certainly would live the holy life of the teacher under whom a disciple attains such a lofty distinction. You get jhanas. So it's, again, not reason, not ear wiggling anymore, not tradition, not, no, just believe me, I'm omniscient. You actually do these things yourself. And when your concentrated mind, or not concentrated, still mind, is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, you can direct it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. I will pause there. The mind has to be still, purified. Purified of what? Purified of wanting. Purified of fear. Because sometimes it's a fear which stops us getting into this sort of stuff. We're going beyond our known world. Malleable, wieldy. And now sometimes, you know, I'm sure that you've got into meditations where you feel that now your mind has got power. If you want to think a thought, you can think nice and clearly. You know, instead of just being able to maintain the stream of thought for about a minute and then you go wandering off somewhere else, you can really take an idea and pursue it to its limit. Or you can take sort of a movement of the mind into your past and pursue it properly. The best simile which I can give is like your mind becomes like, it's not a good simile, but it's the best I came up with, a well-trained dog. So you go and get my slippers. And the dog runs off, wags its tail, comes back with your slippers. And it says, go and sort of get the newspaper. I don't know if they still do it these days. Go and get the newspaper. I probably go and get my iPad. and he comes back with the iPad. I don't know what happens. But you get the idea. Your mind is so well trained, you tell it what to do, and just does it straight away. And it's very malleable, it's wieldy, and it's steady and attained to imperturbability. So you just direct it to knowledge of the recollection of past lives. You just, and I think you all heard what I suggest you to do, is if you have got a deep meditation, just ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? And if your mind is malleable, it will rush off, wagging its tail, and bring back an early memory for you. Yes. Early on in when you were a kid, or a baby, or in your mother's womb, or even earlier. That's cool. And that's real. It's not just belief in traditions anymore, or reason. It's a experience, direct experience for yourself. So, you recollect your manifold past lives. That is one birth, two births. Thus, with the aspects and particulars, you recollect your manifold past lives. A wise man certainly would live the whole life with a teacher on whom a disciple attains such a lofty distinction. So instead of just believing, yeah, Buddhism teaches reincarnation, should I believe it, should I not believe it? Should I use reason and logic, or should I just believe because Ajahn Brahm is omniscient, therefore I have to believe it? Or, no, it's find out for yourself, for goodness sake. And that is where you have a holy life with some consolation. And what a wonderful thing to do is actually to know for yourself once and for all, without doubt anymore, whether there is past lives or not. And find out who you were in the past. Where were you? Why is it you're hanging around this place? Anyway, that's fascinating. That makes it really worthwhile. Yeah? That's good. That's a good one. What a good simile. Yeah, search engine. So you just got to type it in. But you have to have your internet connection first of all, and you have to connect that up with the jhanas. Once you've connected it up, then you can search away. That's a very good one, thank you. I'll use that. Okay, so that's the past lives. And your concentrated or still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. You direct it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. In other words, why they get reborn in this place, or why they get reborn somewhere else. Basically, understanding how karma is a driving force which made you get reborn here as a woman, as a man, intelligent, stupid, or whatever it was. This is actually you find out how this karma works. And you understand beings passing away, appearance, inferior, superior, fair or ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. You understand how beings pass on according to their actions. A wise man certainly would live a holy life with a teacher under whom a disciple attains such a lofty distinction. So at the very least, if you're going to get reborn, you find out what you need to do now to get reborn with a better body or mind or whatever it is, whatever you want in your next life. What you need to do now. So that when you get reborn, you can actually hear the Dharma again. Or, be in a healthier body, or whatever. When your still mind is thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, do you direct it to the knowledge of the destruction of the outflowings, they call it here, the taints? And this is the main one, to become fully enlightened. You understand it actually is. This is suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, the path leading to the end of suffering. That's the Four Noble Truths. So you understand it actually is. This is the way leading to the cessation of everything. When you know and see thus, your mind is liberated from the taint or the outflowing caused by sensual desire, from the outflowing of being, wanting to be, and from the outflowing of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes a knowledge. It is liberated. You understand? Birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. A wise man certainly would live the holy life with a teacher under whom a disciple attains such a lofty distinction. While living it, he would attain the true way, the Dharma that is wholesome. So actually becoming enlightened. So that's a good reason to live the holy life. It's the only reason. But Master Ananda, when a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni or whatever is an arahant with taints destroyed, one who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached a true goal. I like the one laying down the burden. Have you ever thought there's a burden in life? You have to be carrying something? Now that's free of the burden. Have you ever you guys gone shopping or gone to the airport, you're carrying all these heavy suitcases, and now you lay it down, you can relax. It's all checked in, you just go into the aircraft and relax. You're not carrying anything anymore. That's what it's been like. Lay down the burden. Free at last. Where's that gone? Lay down the burden. Done what had to be done. There's no more come to any state of being. A wise man. Oh yeah. But Master Nanda, when a bhikkhu is an arahat, bhikkhuni, taints destroyed, one who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, lay down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge, an arahat, could they still enjoy sensual pleasures? Can you still go out on a Saturday night and have a good time if you're an arahat? Could you still go out and enjoy? Was it somebody, some of the monks were saying there's another, Star Wars. There's another episode of Star Wars. Some of the monks are very upset. They thought they'd seen them all. Now it's another one, they're going to miss them. Poor monks. Could an arahat go out and watch Star Wars? Now have a listen here. Can they still enjoy sensual pleasures? Sandika, when a bhikkhu is an arahat with taints destroyed and is completely liberated through the final knowledge, he is incapable of transgression in five cases. A bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, an arahat, is incapable of deliberately depriving a living being of life. He can't get anything. Incapable of taking what is not given. Can't steal. Incapable of indulging in sexual intercourse. No way. Incapable of knowingly speaking a falsehood. You can't tell a lie. Unknowingly, obviously, that, you know, if you get the wrong end of the stick and you get it wrong, but not intentionally. And lastly, you'd think incapable of the fifth precept, that's the first four precepts of taking alcohol, but it doesn't say that. He's incapable of enjoying sensual pleasures by storing them up as he did formerly in a lay life. I like that one because enjoying sensual pleasures in the aspect of amassing stuff. Because sometimes just the more sensual pleasures you have, the more stuff you tend to collect. Why do you collect that stuff? Oh, just in case. So that's another good side of an enlightened being. Go into their room and find out how much stuff they have. The less stuff they have, the more you let go of the physical world, there's more chance of you letting go of the stuff inside. Storing up stuff. When a monk is an arahat or non-arahat, retains his choice, is incapable of transgression in these five cases. But it actually doesn't actually say whether you can see Star Wars or not, so you may have a loophole there, venerable. But no. But Master Nanda, when a bhikkhu is an arahat with taints destroyed, is his knowledge and vision that his taints are destroyed continuously and uninterruptedly present to him, whether he's walking or standing or sleeping or awake? Is your knowledge that you're an arahat always there? Silly question, but people always think that, you know, you have to be omniscient. You're always aware you're an arahat. As to this, Sandhika, I shall give you a simile. For some wise men or women here understand the meaning of a statement by means of a simile. Suppose a man's hands and feet were cut off. That was a punishment in those days. They still do that in some Arabic countries. Absolutely gross. Suppose someone's hands and feet were cut off. Would he know, my hands and feet are cut off? continuously and uninterruptedly when he is walking or standing or sleeping or awake? Or would he know my hands and feet are cut off only when he reviews this fact? The man, Master Ananda, would not know my hands and feet are cut off continuously and uninterruptedly. Rather, he would only know my hands and feet are cut off only when he reviews this fact. So too, Sandaka, when a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni is an arahat, fully enlightened, their knowledge and vision that you are an arahat are not continuously and uninterruptedly present to you when walking, standing, or sleeping or awake. When you're asleep, you're asleep. Rather, you know my taints are destroyed only when you review this fact. How many emancipated ones, in other words, enlightened ones, are there, you know, in your religion, Master Ananda, Dharma discipline? There are not only 100, Sandaka, or 200, 300, 400, or 500, but far more emancipated ones than that in this Dharma discipline. I don't know why they just don't say there's more than 500. But this is part, they always say, not just 100, 200, 300, 400, more than 500. It is wonderful, Master Ananda, it is marvelous. There is no praising of one's own Dhamma and disparaging of the Dhamma of others. There is just a teaching of the Dhamma in its full range. And wow, so many enlightened ones appear. But these are Jivikas, his own group. They are those mother's dead sons. That's really nasty. They praise themselves and disparage others. And they recognize only three enlightened ones. Nandavacha, Kisa Sankicha, and Makadi Gosala. Those are other teachers at that time. Those are only three they recognize as enlightened. But you say there's over 500 in your group. Now it's interesting. Then the wanderer Sandaka addressed his own assembly, his own disciples. Go, sirs. The holy life is to be lived under the recluse Gotama, under the Buddhists. So he sent his own disciples off, but he wouldn't go himself. Because he said, it is not easy for us now to give up gain, honor, and renown. This teacher was already famous. So even though he knew he was on the wrong path, he said, all his disciples, you go and become Buddhists, don't stay with me. But he couldn't do it himself. Interesting psychology. Thus, that is how the wanderer Sandaka exhorted his own assembly to live the holy life under the Blessed One. And there ends the Sandaka Sutta. An interesting sutta. And in brief, it was four philosophical backgrounds, views, which make living a holy life hopeless. It's one of the reasons why these days the religion is losing ground because of people believe there's either no rebirth, this is the only life you have, there's going to be no heaven, no hell, no future lives, or because, you know, people believe, oh, no real result in karma. That is not so strong, because people, as you said, Annie, that even though they believe maybe there'll be no rebirth, they know it is helpful to be good. And destiny, people don't really believe that these days. Or the Irwigalists, not the Irwigalists, sorry, the what was the fourth one again? Destiny, oh, and the idea that you can't do any good anyway because just seven bodies. And also the fact that just believing in someone who's omniscient, like a god or a pope, that doesn't really inspire people these days. Nor does just believing in tradition, or believing in reason, or just the other one is just people who just spin the truth, they don't really tell what the truth is. That doesn't really make religion or any path popular. But at least in Buddhism, Ananda is saying here that the consolation is that there is a practice, there's something you can do to realize for yourself the benefits. And especially the big benefit of getting a jhana. Once you get one of those, you have huge consolation. And certainly a person would practice Buddhism when that is possible for you. So, okay, we've got any questions from overseas? Oh, we have? Okay. We'll see what we have from overseas. Wow, quite a few. Oh, from Hawaii, from France, Hawaii and USA. Wow. From France. In many interpretations of the sutras are possible, even amongst respected teachers, as I realized when studying the Anapanasati Sutra in detail. How do you choose the right interpretation? First of all, you can actually, first to get you to go to a very good translation, an accurate translation, go there first of all, find out, you know, exactly as much as you can what the Buddha said, and that like limits, you know, the interpretation, because some interpretations of the sutras are really wacky, you know, simply because they're based on very, very strange translations. But even when you get accurate translation, there's still a width for interpretation. So the next thing is start practicing and finding out for yourself. See what works. And if you start to see what works, you do Anapanasati and you do get into deep meditations, especially the jhanas, then when you have your own experience, of course, then you can understand how a real interpretation should be. You are from France. This is Steph from France. It's like I have actually never been to Paris. Been to other parts of France, but never been to Paris. So I can get a guidebook on Paris, like getting the Anapanasati Sutta. And there are some good guidebooks and some bad guidebooks. And so the first thing I should do is get a really accurate guidebook. You know, something which is, you know, someone who really knows what they're talking about. So Anapanasati, get a really good translation. Someone who knows what they're talking about. So I get my guidebook, but then I have to go to that place and feel it out for myself. And once you've been to Paris, following the guidebook, see all the sights and smell the place, feel the place, taste the food, then you know what Paris is. And then you can go back to the guidebooks and then you know for yourself, that's a stupid guidebook. I've been there, it's not like that. This guidebook, that's pretty accurate. So that is actually how eventually you get to the right interpretation. You find the most accurate one you can, and you follow it, go there, and when you've been there, then you know how accurate that interpretation was. And the next one from Hawaii. How can we help someone who thinks that their practice is not going well as not being inspired? Thank you. What you can do if they're practicing, say, meditation. This question reminds me of my early life as a meditator. I was very keen at first for the first year. Then it started dropping off. I wasn't meditating so much. I didn't think I was getting much out of it, basically. And then I remember a French guy. And I don't know his name, but whoever he was, thank you so much for getting me back on track. Because when I said, I used to meditate, but I don't meditate so much these days. And he said, why not? I said, well, it's not really working as well as it used to when I was started. He said, well, why don't you, at the end of every meditation, just ask yourself, at the end of every meditation, how much change have you made since you began? Are you more peaceful than before? And when I asked that question, I found out every meditation, may not be in the best meditation, but every meditation, I got something. I was a little bit more peaceful. Not the great pieces I expected, but it was worth something. And that got me back into meditating. And that's why any of you who come to my classes on a Saturday afternoon, even on a Friday evening when I do a guided meditation, I always say at the very end, now please now feel just, what's it like now after 30 minutes or 45 minute meditation? How peaceful are you? How different are you to when you started? And then you can actually perceive you are actually getting somewhere. And that's really important to inspire you. Even bad meditations, you feel much better than if you didn't meditate at all. And then you feel actually your practice is going well. You're just not noticing it. And once you notice it is going well, you get inspired. And number two, if you think your practice is not going well, ask the people you live with or you work with. And they say, wow, you know, you're a much more peaceful person than you were before. What do you mean you're not going well? And that inspires you when you realize your effect on other people. And from that, you can keep on going. When you get more inspired, your practice goes better and you appreciate it more and you really get into it. Lastly, So if I understand correctly, following the path, keeping the precepts and meditation will reveal the truth of the Dharma regardless of faith. Absolutely, Jib, from the United States. If you follow the path, keep precepts and meditation, regardless of what you believe, you know, you'll find out the truth, because actually you go there. And it's not what you expect. So your faith can only take you so far, because you're believing in something you don't know much about. Again, like Paris, you know, I've never been there, but I actually believe it exists. And I've seen photos of it, and it's been in the news recently. So, but when you go there, you realize what it truly is like. Or you have sometimes, you know, people have these beliefs, I don't like this type of food. I don't know if, you know, whatever food you don't like. And sometimes people give you this food, and, you know, you say, oh, that's really nice. And then afterwards they say, oh, that was that food you don't like. Ah! But it was delicious. So your faith and beliefs can sometimes be overturned totally by experience. So you come across, you know, these deep, beautiful meditations. And then, you know, you see, it's not faith anymore. Or the old, well-used simile. When you get into these deep meditations, the old simile of the tadpole and the frog. The tadpole only knows being in water, so can never understand water. All the faith which a tadpole might have in this thing called dry land. All these frogs go around, they say this dry land. I don't believe a word of dry land. It can't exist. Because for a tadpole, they've only been in water, they've only known water, they can only live in water. But one day the tadpole grows legs and arms, becomes a frog, and jumps out of the lake. This is weird. I've never been here before. Ah, this is what they meant by dry land. Because now you're experiencing it. So whether you have faith in dry land or you don't have faith in dry land, there in the big pond of life, one day when you do grow legs and you jump out, then there it is. So these ideas of jhana, the Dhamma, enlightenment, all this sort of stuff, you can have faith in it, or you cannot have faith in it. But when you become a frog, when that practice happens, you jump out and there it is. So absolutely true, Jim from the United States. You do understand correctly. Following the path, keeping the precepts and meditating will reveal the truth of Dhamma regardless of faith. Also regardless of reason. It just happens. When I say regardless of reason, don't throw out reason, because there's too many people that go to a church or a mosque or even a temple that they leave their brain outside and they don't sort of use a bit of common sense. So keep your common sense, keep your reason, but go to further than reason. Have reason which is tempered by experience. That becomes the best. Make sense? Any questions from Perth? Now, a question from France, from Hawaii, United States. Any from Nolamara, Perth? Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, they never go further. I'm not quite sure what happened to Sandaka after that. Do you know? Any commentaries or something? Oh, I'm sure he did go in a different way. He probably stopped being a teacher and just become a bit of a hermit.
Was he part of the Ajivaka sect?
Ajivaka, yeah.
It was a quite large sect.
It was a large sect, a lot of people. He's obviously quite a well-known teacher at that time. Charismatic, inspiring, and but you know, he was also had faith in what Ananda said. Made a lot of sense to him. So it probably would have changed him a little bit. And who knows, later on in life, you know, he could have become a Buddhist. No one would have known. The whole of life encapsulated in a talk. Well, there's a few other things in life. But yeah, all the different theories and ways people look at religion in our modern life. But it was apt, you know, when people who are traditionalists, who follow the word, you know, without any consideration of nuance or interpretation, or sometimes there may be mistakes in the texts, and that becomes a fundamentalism which causes huge trouble in today's world, and can also cause trouble in Buddhism too. So it's a wonderful balance here when the Buddha is saying, don't just follow a teacher who does things like that. And have a practice, find out for yourself, test it out, see if it works. And always be open to understanding it wasn't recorded correctly. Now keep that possibility open. Keep the possibility open that one has misinterpreted it, or others have misinterpreted it. Because that means you're not a fundamentalist anymore. Yeah, what karma would that be? He had confidence in that teaching, but didn't actually follow it. It was just the case that later on he would. It was just, one of the nice things about believing in many, many lives is the pressure is off you. If you've only got one life, you've got a lot of pressure on you to come up with the goods before you die. But in Buddhism, it's very cool and calm, and if you don't do it this lifetime, there's always another lifetime. So it's a bit more consoling that way.
But actually my question was, if Siddhartha actually could see that that was true, he continued teaching the way that he did originally. I was just saying,
I don't think he would have actually carried on teaching, because he sent his disciples away. He may have actually, but then again, that he still was enjoying his fame. And I know there's a lot of times that in the suttas that, the people say, well, I'm an Ajivaka, I can't stop now. That's what people think I am. So, you know, suppose the Pope, you know, listened to, say, one of our podcasts and thought, wow, this is so inspiring. I want to become a Buddhist. Could the Pope become a Buddhist? Or would his gains and fames mean that, his fame, his position mean that, you know, he'd become a closet Buddhist, but he'd never actually tell anybody? And maybe that's Sandaka. So you think he could become a Buddhist? I think he is a Buddhist. Practice Dharma, okay. Nicholas.
Hi, just a clarification on getting information in deep meditations. Like, is that based purely on seeing your past lives, or is that like some other greater omniscience or something, or is it just reviewing?
Sorry, which one?
Asking questions in deep meditation and getting answers back. Is that based upon viewing past lives, or is it something? Can you ask broader questions than what may have happened in past lives?
And just the way it works is that when you do get deep meditation, everyone who has had reasonably quiet meditation, you can actually probably feel what the Buddha is saying here, that your mind becomes malleable. It's easy to work with. It's not so stubborn and stiff with lots of inertia. So if you do ask a question, it's much easier to find answers. Simple things, just like, what's peace? What's karma? And then the mind can actually see much deeper. It can actually give you answers to those questions.
Thank you.
And that's especially if it's a past life thing, you can actually get some good answers and good memories.
That makes sense, thank you.
Okay. It's an interesting idea that the answers to these deep questions you don't get by study, you don't get by reason, you get through stillness. You don't get by listening to monks like me. You have to have the input, and this is part of the path, part of the causes, but the main way that you get these answers is in the stillness of meditation. That's where you get the wisdom from, and that's your wisdom, it's your seeing. Sorry, is that
yeah
thing, yeah rather than believing in some omniscient guru or what the book says or what reason tells you. Yes.
Thank you. Ajahn Brahm, when the Buddha spoke about regarding oral tradition as truth,
yeah,
and saying that, well, see, one who regards oral tradition, some is well transmitted, some is not, is badly transmitted, some is true and some is otherwise, do you think that that is the Buddha would be referring to Buddhism as well? I mean, obviously Buddhism as it exists now didn't exist then, but is that a justification for us really inquiring and being very, you know,
critical, yeah,
critical of,
exactly,
of, to say things like, I often read suttas where, particularly ones about women, there are really nasty things that are said about women, where you think, well, this is rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
But you are reading it in the suttas. I mean, but some people take them as absolute truths.
Exactly. So, that, first of all, you know, you have to look at that, study that. And, you know, there's a lot of really powerful monks, people like Ajahn Sujata, you know, Bhumali Anālaya. Mm. And they're coming up with some really good stuff, you know, which is, yes, we have that oral tradition, and it was actually written down sometime later. But, you know, sometimes we know there has been some additions. And this is why Ajahn Sujata and Bhumali did that authenticity project. A way not to tell you what is authentic, what isn't authentic, but how you can find out what's authentic, what's not authentic. Obviously, one big danger there is it doesn't make sense. The Buddha couldn't have said this. And that's not a good argument at all. It's much better to say, well, you know, the Buddha was couching his teachings in the culture of the times. That's a much better argument. But it also means, you know, that just because the Buddha said it, you know, does not mean it's an ultimate truth. And the Buddha actually said that.
Really?
Yeah, of course. Oh, you know, the Kalama Sutta, things like that.
Oh.
Around Ubanga.
Well, he wasn't saying, talking about himself there, he was talking about generally teachers in general.
Yes, right, yeah. But also himself, you know, he's part of that. That's why people who take the Kalama Sutta as the ultimate truth, you know, without any criticism, they should always criticize the Kalama Sutta.
Yes. There's some funny translations of that one, too. So, for an individual who's practicing Dhamma, does the Buddha advise them to practice in a way that is true for them? I mean, is
of course.
This a way of
we have
right?
Yeah, we have the suttas.
Like for me, I read some things that I think are just wrong.
Yeah.
And I'll discard them.
Exactly, discard them. But, you're allowed to do that. You won't become a heretic.
But if you're in a monastery,
if it's in a good monastery, you will not become a heretic. Because good monasteries, you know, they understand that people are going to be learning. The suttas are the foundation, but it's, you know, a foundation which, you know, every foundation will have a few cracks in it, and sometimes the cracks because they're wrongly understood, they're wrongly translated or whatever. But something which Venerable Ñāṇaponika told me, you get the mass of the suttas, not one particular passage, the whole mass of them. And the whole mass of them is more less likelihood there's going to be too many misinterpretations when you hold a huge amount of information, which is all pointing in the same direction. The principle which, you know, Ajahn Sujata was saying of convergence.
Yeah.
It's all converging, all pointing to the same beautiful teaching.
Which is why the ones about, the few about women, really stand out because
they're not
mostly,
yeah.
It's they're, you know, treated as.
Exactly, yeah.
Same as everybody else, but,
so it doesn't fit. Now, I know one of the ones you're talking about, the Garudhammas, where the Buddha, when he ordained bhikkhunis, said, oh, now ordained bhikkhunis, the teachings are only going to last another 500 years. And there's a lot of problems with that. Number one, the Buddha was wrong, because Buddhism has lasted much more than 500 years, with at least 2,500 years since that time. And it's still going strong. So if the Buddha did make that prophecy, it was wrong. And number two, it stands out because the Buddha didn't make prophecies. He never said things like that. It's the only place. So it does stand out. But this seems a bit weird and strange. So those are some of the reasons why that people say it doesn't fit the whole mass of other teachings. So that's fair enough. If you follow the whole mass of other teachings, you know, about gradual training, keeping precepts, you know, being a good person, not criticizing others, but just meditating, abandoning the five hindrances, sense restraint, living simple lives, meditating. The whole mass of teachings, that's the core, the spine of Buddhism.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. So I think that's enough for today. Thank you. That was supposed to be a long sutta, but it's only an hour and a half and lots of questions. That went down pretty well. So thank you all for coming. Sadhu. Okay, now we can play the Special Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Now we do the Arahang Sama.